This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Bill Meeks at Meeks Mixed Media, maximizing brands, large and small, in the new media space, on the web at meeksmixedmedia.com. And by Telos Systems, the best way to hear from there, on the web at telos-systems.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
If you actually have to put series resistance in the reference capacitor, I'd like a 10-ohm pot in the reference capacitor, or else you'd never get nulled out.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Chris Tobin and Tom Ray join me in welcoming Bill and Kimberly Sachs for a really techie show.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, and I'm your host for the show today. Along with me are a couple of regular co-hosts and a very special couple who's a guest of ours. And I've been very excited to have this couple on for a while now. And also just glad kind of to reconnect with the guy of this couple. We'll introduce them in just a minute. There they are. Hey, let's introduce our roundtable first. Let's go. Oh, hey. Let's go to the Hudson Valley of New York and say howdy to Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Live long and prosper, Kirk. Hi, how you doing? I'm Vice President of Engineering at Buckley Broadcasting, WOR Radio in New York City.
And glad you are, too. Also with us from New York, from Manhattan, it's the engineer, man about town, the best-dressed engineer in the city, and that's Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. Hello, Tom. How is everyone this evening?
Hey, glad Chris, you're with us. A long time no see.
Yes, exactly.
did you guys have lunch together in the city today or something?
A little inside joke. We lent a corner to Chris for 9/11 coverage for 10/10 Winds, and he came over yesterday to pick up his equipment.
Okay. Yep. Well, good. Yep, see, good of you to do that. That radio cooperation thing, always good. And people never know what goes on behind the scenes like that. You know, I mean, it's MSNBC helping out Fox News. Well, maybe not.
Never.
So anyway, let's get to our guests, because we're going to have them on for the whole show. They got a lot of stories to tell. And that's Bill Sachs and his wife, Kim Sachs. Hello. How you guys doing from Hollywood, Maryland?
Hi. We're doing pretty good tonight. Microphone is working now. And
beautiful evening.
So let me make a quick introduction here of Bill and Kim, and then I'm sure Bill will kind of go into some detail. For those of you who are broadcast engineers who are familiar with the company Straight Wire Audio, then you know something about Bill Sachs. And maybe Bill did a lot of things before Straight Wire Audio. I guess he probably did. But a lot of engineers came to know Straight Wire Audio for their phono preamps, because they were just absolutely magnificent. If you had a turntable you're going to put on the air, and back in the 70s and 80s, you did. Bill made a turntable preamp that was absolutely premier, well-designed, and just loved by engineers who knew what they were doing. Not that I knew what I was doing. I just copied the guys who did. So then I didn't hear from Bill for several years. It seemed to go away. We'll find out what he was doing. And then he reappears at an NAB show. I think it was in Philadelphia when I met Bill and I met Kim. And they sat down and had dinner table of us.
What were we in the broadcast?
We were showing off this box, the USB matchbox that we had designed for Henry Engineering. We do hired gun engineering for Henry. We've done, I don't know, 7 or 8 products for Henry Engineering now.
Yeah.
And I think you told me that it was Kimberly that had all the brains behind the USB design.
Well, both of us did that together. I helped Bill move into the digital age here. He's a real analog guru and a genius when it comes to analog design. But he needed a little push into the direction of the digital era.
Well, I had sort of a bad taste in my mouth, because Straight Wire Audio actually introduced the first U.S.-made CD player, which also was so successful it put us out of business.
You know, that's what I always heard, and I think maybe you told me that. Let's save that story for a few more minutes. Bring us up to right now what you guys are doing. Just touch on that, and then we'll start back at the beginning. Aren't you guys doing some kind of resurrection work?
Well, we are fortunate in that we were kicking around between some different things, and Marty Acuff of Orban and Bob Orban, and we were having a conversation at Barry Mishkin's lunch one day, I think, and
Bob was with us too,
and Marty was lamenting the fact that nobody who worked at Orban was still there who remembered the 8000s and the 9000s. And I was sort of a hanger-on at the company when I was young. I used to go hang out at the factory, and I watched those things being made. So Marty suggested, and Bob suggested, that I start taking care of Bob's adult children that aren't necessarily known too well by his current wife, so to speak. And so I sort of adopted Bob's adult children, so to speak, and started servicing the analog stuff for them. And the relationship's been wonderfully symbiotic. Bob's an old friend and a mentor, a great teacher in my life. So that's how it started, and we secured the site optmod.fm.
Actually, that was a Christmas gift for Bill a few years ago.
I was sort of puttering. I've been hot-rodding Optmods for 30 years, but Kim and my friend Craig Siegenthaler, who operates Kiwa, K-I-W-A.com, does shortwave receiver antennas and filters, and Kim conspired to get optmod.fm and optimod.am as domain names, and to actually make it into a business. And now we do this basically full time. It just sort of evolved, and we love taking care of them, and we've developed some even new modifications for them. And everything we do has been approved by Bob Orban as keeping with his original algorithms, his intent, and keeping the character of that Orbanian musicality, that special musicality that those processors have. And he's been gracious enough to trust us with even the internals of some of the old black modules used in the older units so that we can reproduce them under his guidance and be able to fully service the things.
Yeah.
So let me ask a real basic fundamental question about updating or upgrading an analog audio processor. Back some years ago, when I was doing regular broadcast engineering, I took care of a number of stations that had the Optimod 8000 or the 8000A audio processor. And I started reading about, and a friend of mine, you know, faxed me some instructions on how to make the Optimod 8000A sound better by replacing some of the chips with chips that supposedly maybe had a higher slew rate or some other characteristics that were good. And of course, doing normal things like replacing the electrolytic capacitors, which, you know, those are going to dry out and lose their value over time anyway, but some other other modifications and lift a pin here or there. Tell me what I was doing. How did these early modifications to the 8000 come about, and what sort of things did they do? And then let's later on get into where you've progressed in modifying and updating the more recent processors from Orban, the more recent analog ones.
Well, it's kind of funny because I know for a fact that I was the first person to actually present an Optimod 8000 to the factory with bifed op-amps in it, which are higher slew rate. Slew rate is simply the ability of the op-amp to follow the signal at a particular speed. And I was always a student of Walt Jung. I got to know him, and he was adamant about increasing the slew rate of op-amp circuits for audio and showing the effects of what's called SID, slewing-induced distortion. But I presented an Optimod to the factory with higher slew rate op-amps where I thought they made a difference, and asked them to recertify it because back then the FCC required that the stereo generator be a type accepted or type approved, whatever. I'm not an FCC legal type. And anyway, so I wanted to make sure this was for DC-101, a DC radio station. And so I sent the Optimods back to be, quote, recertified, recalibrated. And that's how the conversation got started. And it's not just replacing electrolytics because they dry up. Electrolytics are horrible capacitors for audio. I've been passionate about capacitor distortion for a very long time. And another mentor of mine, Walt Chung, published quite a few papers about this. And now it's almost exactly 40 years, I'm going to reveal Straightwire Audio's major trade secret, since it doesn't really matter.
Was that our capacitor checker?
Yeah. I have a homemade box for checking audio distortion in capacitors, and built with Walt Chung's guidance. And the box was somewhere around here. I thought we brought it up to show.
It's in the basement.
But anyway.
Okay.
It's in the workshop right now.
And
so,
the wait, secret
so, Bill, this thing checks capacitors, and it can lead you to believe whether or not a given capacitor is good or not good for passing audio through it?
Document the amount of audio distortion in the capacitor. And I don't know why this thing didn't be, well, you know, I know why, because we didn't talk about it much.
But explain how you've got the Teflon capacitor.
Oh, okay. The way it works is, and Kim said no whiteboards. This could be hard to do. But you basically, you start with a reference capacitor, Teflon, if you have one, say a 1 microfarad Teflon capacitor, military type capacitor with extraordinarily low dielectric absorption and low ESR, effective series resistance. And anyway, you put that in one side of a circuit that you build like a balanced bridge, like a four-terminal device where you have two RC networks, one of them with the reference capacitor, and you set it at 100 hertz. And the other side of the bridge is your capacitor under test. And it doesn't have to be the same value. You can use a 1 microfarad film capacitor to test a 1,000 microfarad electrolytic, as long as you make the resistor and the electrolytic product, RC product, the same as the RC product of the first one.
Oh, so the time constant of the circuits of each side needs to be the same, right?
Right, so the same pole, basically, that you create. And then you feed a square wave into it, and you null it out as best you can, looking at it with a differential amplifier used in analog devices, AD524 instrumentation app to do this.
Yeah.
And you actually, with the... when you do like an electrolytic, you actually have to put series resistance in the reference capacitor. I had like a 10 ohm pot in the reference capacitor, or else you'd never get it nulled out. But you null it out as best you can with a square wave at about a kilohertz. And then, for real grins, you feed program audio into it. And you listen to the difference between the reference capacitor, which is sort of an ideal capacitor, and your electrolytic that you're deciding whether or not it's a good audio capacitor or a ceramic or whatever. And they all have different characters of this. And the worst is like a 0.1 or 1 microfarad green disc ceramic. You put that in one side, and it sounds like the distortion of a transistor radio, or the classic transistor sound, which I attribute to the coupling capacitors most of the time. And you can, and also they're so microphonic. The when you have them in that sensitive circuit, you can take your greeny screwdriver across that ceramic and go like chalk across a blackboard.
In fact, you used to do that at your talks.
I used to do that sometimes at talks for people, show them that the ceramics were also microphonic. This is very important in the live PA business, that you have this console full of microphonic capacitors in front of Pink Floyd doesn't always work. But anyway, so the capacitor selection, getting back to what we do to the old Optimods, part of it is critical audio path capacitors and very carefully selected caps. We actually have had caps made for us. We own the brand name OptiCap. We don't sell too many of them except during the refurbishing. And they're polystyrenes that we had wound. It's very hard to find polystyrene blank material anymore, but we had a supplier overseas was able to get some. But most of the time we use polypropylene for sort of the workman type task. And we have some bipolars that are very, very nice sounding. That we used to use the Panasonic bipolars you can buy in DigiKey, and they're still pretty good. And we certainly did a lot of Optimods with them, but the latest capacitors we've been using are much nicer. And also, never, ever just put a raw electrolytic in series with the audio. Always have at least like a 0.1 or 1 microfarad film in parallel with it to take care of the high frequencies.
Now, somebody a long time ago told me that a typical electrolytic capacitor's equivalent circuit includes a diode in the equivalent circuit mm-hmm. Is that true?
Of a polar type.
Yeah.
And you can spoof that, by the way, by putting two of them in series with their pluses together and putting like a 10 mega ohm resistor up to the plus supply between them and making sure they're always turned on, like a turned on diode. That's a very good point. And bipolar electrolytics have that effect is much diminished. You really don't want ever have an electrolytic passing audio, if possible, polarized type without a polarizing voltage, because the polarizing voltage forms the capacitor.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, audio coupling caps would, quote, wear out, unquote, say in an Audimax.
Right.
Because they didn't have a polarizing voltage across them. And so eventually the initial charge that formed the plates of the capacitor would dissipate.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was the, quote, wearing mechanism besides, quote, drying out.
Now, you've mentioned polystyrene capacitors, and you've mentioned Teflon capacitors. You're talking about the dielectric material out of which the capacitor is made. What about, it seems like for a while people were using tantalum capacitors to replace electrolytics in a lot of audio circuits, and I found out later that may not be a good idea.
I'll tell you that I'm so grateful that there are tantalum capacitors throughout the Optimod 8000 because it allows me to make such a dramatic improvement in sound. The tantalum capacitor is absolutely the worst audio coupling cap, and they are real bottlenecks. And once again, say in the Optimod 9000, there were a lot of tantalums in the path, and replacing all of those changes the character of that box. It turns it into this like super sweet sounding, pretty box. So now tantalums, those orange tantalums, they're very nice for the 4th of July. I put them across an AC outlet. My friend Roger calls them bangables.
Bangables, yeah.
Bangables. Okay. Hey, I've been watching the chat room, and so has Burke back at the Twit Network. One question that we're getting is that, you know, I've realized, hey, we're all talking inside baseball here, pretty heavy duty, and that's what the show's about. But some people are asking, what does an Optimod do? And in previous shows, we have talked about audio processing for AM and for FM and not for TV yet, but also for coded audio, like for streaming.
Yes.
So tell you what, Bill, I'm gonna put you on hold for just a second because we've got a couple of audio processing other experts here who haven't gotten to talk much today. Tom Ray is on with us. Tom, why don't you give the audience your description of what an Optimod does, and maybe you know a couple things about the history of Orban's Optimod that would be interesting, and then we'll get back to Bill.
Well, the Optimod, as you said, Kirk, is an audio processor, and what an audio processor does in this case, it controls the levels. It'll make the audio louder with compression. It holds. It gives you maximum peak control, so you don't overmodulate the transmitter. It adjusts the equalization, and in the case of the AM Optimod, it does the certain things that you want for AM transmission. For example, it'll roll off above 10 kilohertz. Because we can't transmit that, it'll allow you to give asymmetrical audio output, so you can go up to 125% positive peaks. On the FM, and what a lot of people don't realize is that FM is thought of as being a noiseless transmission medium, and that's actually incorrect, because as the modulating frequency increases, so does the noise. So what happens in FM transmission is we have to boost the high frequencies by as much as 15 dB at 15 kilohertz. And the radio, of course, does the opposite to that, but now you have to handle the audio a little bit differently, because you have this big peak at the high frequencies, and you have to make sure that is handled differently, and the peaks are controlled, so everything you know, stays where you're going to be, and you're not where you need to be, and you are not over-modulating the transmitter. In addition to that, the FM audio processor, or the FM OptiMod, generally contains the stereo generator, and we could probably do a whole show on stereo generation and how it works, but it generates the FM stereo signal.
And not to interrupt you, but wasn't the OptiMod, the first OptiMod that Bob Orban designed, wasn't that the first processor to incorporate the stereo generator and the audio processor in the same box, which just made all kinds of sense to do, but nobody had done that yet. Is that right?
I don't know, but Bill and Kim would know.
Bill?
Yes. Yes, that was the revolutionary aspect of the OptiMod. There were a couple things about the OptiMod 8000, which I believe single-handedly made FM commercially viable, because it allowed somebody who did not have particularly good audio insights to take a one-box solution and turn it on and achieve peak modulation levels without overshoot, without it sounding overly processed. So FM sounded very clean and stayed in the channel at the same time. The 8000 incorporated a very good stereo generator for its time. In fact, it's so good that once they're rechipped and tuned back up, they're still competitive with anything on the market for their auditory quality. Just beautiful sounding stereo generator, and set up with internal trimmers and stuff so that the filtering and limiting was set up in such a way that Bob had patents on nonlinear filters, such that there was a clipper embedded into the filter in such a way that the overshoot of the filter was clipped off, the overshoot compensated clipper. And allowed him to do a very steep filter with very low overshoot, which started the whole thing. And sort of like the Bee Gees joke, I started a joke that started the whole world laughing. It started everything.
Bill, actually, you mentioned something there that was quite revolutionary. And for our audience members, you know, when an audio designer designs a filter, you've got to let 15 kilohertz frequencies pass, and you've got to make 16 or 17 kilohertz frequencies not pass or be way, 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 way down. Whenever you design a filter like that, you are going to get overshoots in the audio level that comes out of that filter. So maybe you had the audio controlled going into the filter, and you just want to get rid of anything above 15 kilohertz for the FM stereo system. Well, what comes out of the filter, yeah, it's devoid of anything above 15 kilohertz, but now it's no longer level controlled as well as it was before. And when you got preemphasis, and when you've got really strict modulation limits on FM, and you want to use every bit of modulation that you can as a competitive broadcaster, hey, these overshoots become a problem because they modulate the transmitter without adding to the loudness or the intelligibility of the signal. So, tell us why that's important.
And there's an art to designing filters, and Bob was the first person to really apply computer-aided design to these filters. He was inspired by Arno Meyer of Belar to produce a low overshoot filter. Then Bob had the stroke of genius, which he's had many, to compensate for these brief overshoots in the filter in a very elegant way. And then when I first met Bob, and I showed him.
Oh, please excuse the flyover. We're right near the naval base.
We're near the naval base. But anyway, and he pointed me to some math books and said, there are some holes in your background you need to fill if you want to fool with filters. So anyway, I just wanted, speaking of the overshoot control, we have two little snippets that are a surprise for everybody, which is we did a phone interview with Bob last night that turned out to take about an hour. We just wanted to do a real quickie cameo. So we telescoped it a bit, and we actually have two little snippets, one in which he discusses his most recent invention, which is a very, very clever method of look-ahead limiting, which produces no overshoots for, you know, pre-emphasis limiting. It's just an amazing technique. And the other, I guess, we're just rambling together about old.
You two always ramble.
We're old friends, and we just ramble together sometimes. And Kim selected some of that to put in. So we have two snippets. One, they're each about 2 or 3 minutes long. That we have like carts set up here, basically. Not a cart machine, but virtual carts.
Okay, so if you want to play that, we'll show the Orban homepage or your homepage while you're playing. This is an interview with Bill Sachs and Bob Orban, the famous designer of the Orban audio processor. So go ahead and play it at will.
Do you want to go with
go with the old one first.
Okay.
And I'll push the button, and hopefully it won't sound too horrible. Ready? Students of psychoacoustics would do well to study the topology of the Optimod 9000, incorporating delay. You hear it? Look at the distortion masking characteristics of the audio before it hit the actual real clipper, and allowing a decision to be made in advance as to how much clipping to allow. And this is, Bob, you know, before MP3s, you were doing psychoacoustic masking in real time with that crazy logic circuit in the 9000.
Yeah, that's something I'm fairly proud of, that I think the 9000 was way ahead of its time in terms of incorporating a real psychoacoustic model. And this was, as you said, even before the work of the Kodak people started to become widely disseminated. I believe they were working on it in Bell Labs and a few other places back in the late 70s. But the inspiration for that actually came more from Ray Dolby's taping noise reduction system, where he did band division, but only into four rather wide bands. But that led me to read some of the psychoacoustic literature, learned about critical bands being a third octave wide, and so that's what we used in the model of the 9000.
That whole series of filters and doublers, I believe, I guess it's card 6 or 8 or one of those.
Six is the, no, never mind, that's a 9100.
Well, anyway, I love that box. I really enjoy doing them because you put up the power supply, you know, and beef it up and put all the new audiophile op amps. And, you know, you did that with 4558s, my God, you know, just replacing the 4558s in the equalizer by itself is like this massive improvement.
Yeah, I believe that they didn't even have 5532s back then when that thing was designed.
That's right. All of the 5534 requirements were single socket chips. You had a lot of single socket chips in that one. And that's a labor of love to work on, but we have our cultists who just love their 9000s, and we take care of them.
Yeah, one of the more controversial decisions regarding that box was my choice to put a 100 hertz high pass filter in it, because I figured that there were a great many more small radios out there than there were radios with loudspeakers large enough to produce anything below 100 hertz. And that also made life easier on the tube-type transmitters of the day. A lot of plate-modulated stuff still in daily service at that time. Of course, that was a different era by far than where we are today. So eventually, Greg Oganowski persuaded me that, you know, I should really take that down to 50 hertz, which is what we recommended that people do when they put in the NRC modification.
The only modification, which you, of course, know about, you know, what the XT is, that base mod of, you know, putting one frequency on one knob and another frequency on the other octave apart and doing it the boost only in mono. You know, we're very careful to try to maintain the integrity of your algorithms, what you're trying to do.
I certainly appreciate that.
And we appreciate the platform to work from. It's, like a Stradivarius violin. It's fun just making nice again.
Unless it's come in with several of the resistor values changed and capacitors changed and the filters adjusted. And
adjusted those, are
the times, those are the times that, that I wish.
We had one that had sat outside for 3 years that required naval rust jelly all over the chassis. And wherever there is.
Sat outside for 3 years under a tarp on top of Mount Wilson.
Anything ferrous on the chassis was orange rusted, but we got it working perfectly. And that's a tribute to Kramlin, which we can talk about another time.
Yeah, well, at least when you get modified units, and you can hope that they didn't bother to get rid of the flux when they did the modifications, so at least you can find the changes quickly.
That's usually the case. People rarely bother to wash circuit boards. That's one thing we're very careful about, is washing our boards before we stick them back in, especially on card 7.
The 8100 card 7 has to be immaculately clean.
Yeah, I'm glad that you are limiting your modifications to making the signal path more transparent.
That's it.
Okay. Hey, so that was Bob Orban. I know you've got another interview snippet. We might do that a little bit later in the show. So I was looking around, and I know that you guys like to post a few videos on YouTube. There was one that I think might give our listeners and viewers a better idea of what you guys do. This video that it's featuring, I don't know if we can play this or not. Can we play a video that's got some, yeah, we can do it, because this is a professional demonstration application. The copyright that's rules, right, don't apply for a short
it's
bit like this.
Under fair use.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the Thomas Dolby video that Burke is going to play for us. And Bill, maybe you or Kim could narrate a bit while this YouTube video plays and tell us what we're looking at here and what you've done to this equipment. You know, what did it come in needing, and what have you done to it? Burke, can you roll that YouTube video I sent you a link for? There we go. What's going on here?
This is one of the units I had done.
Can they hear the audio?
I'm not sure if the audio goes through, but this is a unit I had worked on, and it had the base modification that we offer installed, cleverly called the club modification, the centered low uniform base modification, which Bill can describe a little bit better than I can.
Well, it takes the XT base controls, and instead of boosting left and right at the same frequency, two separate knobs, each knob is separate frequency. One is 55, the other is 110. And they each just boost L plus R only, which prevents imbalance of the low frequencies, which causes unnecessary modulation of the subcarrier.
Okay.
You just don't really hear separation at the low frequencies anyway.
Sure.
So it's essentially a subwoofer boost. And it works extraordinarily well.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
And it gives you a lot of contouring ability, because you can have one large, wide hump, and you can vary the relationship of 110 and 55 for just whether you want table radio bass or subwoofer car bass, or some sort of compromise between them. It's been universally accepted, and people seem to like it quite a bit. There's Kim's hand on the knob.
Yeah, that's me switching through the different meter and positions, just to let the videos, you know, show on the video the different meter positions.
My friend Dwight Douglas, you know, the purpose of the videos is for people to hear the processing as best they can through the flash player, but my friend Dwight Douglas says the video part of it's pretty boring. just have a box sitting there.
That's why we have you. That's why we have you narrating. So you told us a minute ago about this OptiMod you received that had naval jelly all over. Tell us another horror story or two about a really neglected OptiMod that you raised back to life. And I guess it would be on the air.
You know, that people think that they somehow know more about processing algorithms than the guru himself, Bob, and we get them in with these really toxic modifications, and we bring them back to factory stock and better, just improve transparency of the audio path, but maintaining the Orban algorithms and clipping thresholds and stuff, which were set so carefully. You know, Bob listens to classical music all the time. In fact, he's actually a classical composer of note that few people realize. He's been published as a classical composer and his works performed.
But some of the units that come in are better than others. Some of them have simple modifications that were standard back in the 80s, such as removing the phase rotators on the input card.
If somebody had a Texar in front of it or whatever, whenever we encounter one of those, we change that to a movable jumper for the person so they can go back to the all-pass filter as designed or use the Texar all-pass filter if they're having one in front of it.
And other modifications we've seen that are particularly
stupid ones in the 8000. People did not understand how Bob had fed forward that 709 op amp and force fed bias into its nose to make it class A. And just plug a 5534 in there. I have no idea. Sometimes people would not really have the right. They just didn't understand. And so everything we do, I talk to Bob about what we do and make sure that it's in keeping with the original design philosophy, just to improve it with the modern parts and the better capacitors and such and sweeten it up.
There were also other modifications done in the XT accessory chassis.
Oh, now tell us tell our listeners what the XT accessory chassis is. That was the box that was on top of the box in the video, right? We had like 6 meters.
You're right. The XT was the pinnacle of analog audio processing, a 6-band limiter that had distortion canceled clipping. Now, I know this sounds funny, but we have OptiMod 8100s with XTs that we've restored and made better than new, and they're on major market radio stations like Los Angeles, where the guy is saying, don't you ever tell anybody that we're running the analog 8100 XT. It is a competitive advantage, and our numbers are good, and we want to sound pretty and open. So I was accused by one company of servicing a cult. I said, that's all right. They're my friends.
But, the XT chassis is a 6-band limiter accessory, as Bill mentioned. And sometimes when they come through here, we'll find that people have
offset bands and stuff like that.
Offset the bands. They've adjusted the gain settings. Sometimes they change the resistor and capacitor values in the crossover networks.
Which are beautifully designed. And there's some secrets in those cross.
Done.
See, there's a lot of subtle stuff that I'm so glad that Bob talks to us constantly. And he's so good about supporting us with this because there are so many little subtle circuit tricks that he's using that he doesn't bother to document because of the competitive nature of the business at the time, people copying each other and stuff. And there are some crazy things going on in NXT that are not obvious to somebody not particularly skilled in the art and not having the insight of having talked to Bob about them. And some of these things, you have to be very, very careful to preserve what Bob was doing. And when you do it, the thing is just absolutely gorgeous sounding. We see a lot of times where people didn't understand what Bob was doing. And that's the biggest problem.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really interesting concept. Engineers thinking that they can make something sound better. And of course, it's so much of what audio sounds like, good, bad, better, worse. It's we often think it's in the ear of the beholder, right? But there are a lot of untrained ears out there. And that can be a dangerous thing. If you think you know what you're doing and you don't, and maybe to you it sounds like it's shucking and jiving, and to the audience it may not sound any better or may sound worse. And to a trained ear, it may sound really worse.
Here's how it works, in my opinion, that you're trained ear, and I've mixed live music. That's another part of my career, doing live music manager act type stuff. I have a patent on the earphones that people use in my performance. And that's my reference is live music. And it's Bob's reference too. I remember Bob, he was working on a particular overshoot compensated device, which is basically a clipper. And he was saying he just spent all day at the symphony and then come home to have to work on this clipper and, quote, felt like slitting his wrists over it because no matter what you did, it was still clipped. And that it still, no matter what he tried, it just wasn't exactly like the classical music. And that's his perspective, that the integrity of the music, the musicality of it, but at the same time, processing it in such a way to make optimum use of the channel without destroying the audio in the process and trying to apply some kind of a signature to the audio because you think maybe you know better what to do with it than the producer who Fleetwood Mac hired to do that.
Hey, Chris Tobin, I want you to jump in here for a second. You are with the CBS stations in New York, and I guess I'm not going to take the liberty to mention, you know, what processing they're using now because that's a secret, but you've got plenty of experience with the Orban AM processors there in the at big 50 kilowatt blowtorch stations. Why don't you jump in here and give us a comment or two and see what reaction you can get out of Bill. Chris Tobin, you're on. It's you.
Sorry, I'm back. My video dropped for some reason. Who knows why, but so be it. I'm back. Hey, Smart Clipper in the Optimod FM. Can you describe and talk a little bit about that? Because that was the one part that I enjoyed the most. That part of the box that seemed to do the real trick and magic for some of the things I did with FM stations. And every time I talk to folks about it, they're just like, hey, you know, I'm not sure what it does, but I like it. Oh, well, come on.
What part of the box?
We had smart a dropout clipper. For a second there.
Oh, no.
The smart clip.
Oh, the smart clipper.
Oh, the smart, you know.
That's our favorite circuit, isn't it?
Well, you know, in the 9000 smart clipper, it's funny because the part of the interview with Bob we went off on that is that the probably one of the first actual practical applications of psychoacoustic masking, long before MP3.
Whoa, psychoacoustic what?
Masking.
Okay, you know, can you define that for us in a couple sentences?
Well, it's easy for me to talk about because it's been sort of a passion of mine. I actually hold a pioneering patent in psychoacoustics. We should have the patent number to flash up, but it's how people are used, how audio is fed back now to performers for their fullback on their earphones, the in-ear earphones that they wear on stage.
Yeah, so there's a whole secret in science to that?
Yeah. Actually, I'm the patent holder for it, and is our pioneering artists were Stevie Wonder, Roberta Flack, Luther Vandross, Axl Rose. That's what I did after Straight Wire.
Oh,
for a
okay.
Long time. I did live sound.
But back to the smart clipper.
The smart clipper is
scary circuit.
It's not scary to me. It scares Kim, but I understood what Bob's intent was, and it uses psychoacoustic masking, which is a key component in any data reduction, you know, codec like AAC or MP3. But Bob did it before it was widely published, and it was part of the smart clipper. And basically, what it did is it listened to see if the clipping distortion would be masked by other audio.
And if
the clipping distortion would be masked, it was allowed to clip more. The way it was able to do this was having a bucket brigade delay, which enabled you to have a few milliseconds to make that decision. Is the audio going to sound off? I'm sorry, I'm being told my video manners are very bad. I'm just not used to video. So it would know how perceptible the distortion was in advance by using delay line. And there was sidechain clipper that clipped. And if the sidechain clipper's products were not going to be masked, as determined by a set of filters in the critical bands and monitoring them, then the drive to the clipper was reduced. That was the first generation smart clipper. Then the distortion canceling clippers came along later on when Bob had the flash of genius, Bob has flashes of genius like the rest of us have a bowl of cereal. We had a flash of genius and realized that he could use the low-pass filter's delay to accomplish much of what the Bucket Brigade was doing, and very cleverly was able to add a distortion canceling component in the multiband box, i.e. the 9100, and then that concept further evolved into the 8100's distortion canceling, and then into the XT's multiband distortion canceling, which was based on things learned in the 9100. The 9100 is still the best sounding AM processor on the planet, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
And we have 9100s that we've rehabbed on major flamethrowers all over the world, and it is, to many people, the preferred AM box. Nothing ever came close to the fact that it can be loud and sweet at the same time. And part of that is Bob protected all this stuff. He has like 25 patents, and so not everything, but there's a lot of stuff that you hear where they're trying to work around Bob's patents. But it's hard, I don't want to sound like I'm just myopically promoting the sound of the analog Optimods, but there sure is something special about it.
Yeah, I would agree. Yep. I would agree with that. Yep. Definitely.
I think any engineer who's compared processors would agree with that. And of course, some people like a Ford, some people like a Chevy, but the Orban sound certainly is identifiable because it is very sweet. It's a very sweet and classy kind of sound. Hey, I'm really curious, Bill, about something that you mentioned earlier, trying to understand it just a bit more, and I almost had a flash of understanding here. You mentioned that, you know, whenever you do clipping, and we do that to obtain loudness and to, you know, reduce the peak-to-average ratio, but when you do clipping, you can induce distortion from that, and the distortion products from a clipper are going to be odd multiples of the fundamental. So you're going to create odd-order harmonics in frequency than what you're clipping,
odd,
right?
Even more harmonics, and whenever you have two signals clipped at the same time, you create intermodulation products.
Too, because it's a clipper would be nonlinear. But then you mentioned that if the audio program that you're listening to has audio up there, audio energy where these clipping products would be anyway, and they're louder than the clipping products would be, then the natural audio that's there can have the effect of masking the distortion products. And I think you were saying that lets you get away with more distortion because you won't end up hearing it. Is that what the concept is?
That was the earlier approach.
Right, the early one.
That was the early approach of the Optimod 9000 by employing delay line. And then the approach became even more elegant when it became an actual cancellation of the distortion rather than trying to mask it, rather than allowing it. And that made things a lot louder because
is that,
it could clip.
Is that canceling something that you can explain, or is that beyond the scope of this discussion?
Well, okay. Whenever you clip, you create these distortion products. If you canceled all of the clipping, you would undo the clipping, and you would have the same amount of peak overshoot that you had before you clipped.
Right.
So you can't just take a clipper and extract the raw signal versus the clip signal, differential clipper, and then look at the clipping products and add them back in out of phase because you've just undone the clipping. What you want to do is undo the part of the clipping that is causing the psychoacoustic irritation, say particularly around intermod products that would fold back into the sensitive area of hearing at about 2 kilohertz. So there's a selective folding back of the distortion products in such a way that there's just enough of it folded back so that it doesn't cause too much regrowth, so to speak, of the peak level. And then there's a safety clipper beyond that takes off some of this added energy that from the distortion canceling. But it's a very careful balance of how much you apply to undo your clipping at the places where it's going to cause intermodulation products that bother you. Another trick that Bob had patented early was in the 8100, there was a clipper on the base that allowed the bass compressor to have a nice smooth response and simply roll, and then to embed the bass compressor with the clipper inside of the crossover to only have two of the poles in front of it and one pole after it in the band crossover allowed the distortion products to be filtered off, because that is just harmonic distortion products. You won't have intermod between two bass notes interfering with something else. It's the intermod between, say, a 14 kilohertz signal and a 15 kilohertz signal producing a 1 kilohertz product. That's the irritating part. So the bass clipping is completely different than the high-frequency clipping. The high-frequency is distortion-canceled, and the low-frequency clipping is simply the distortion, harmonic distortion products, as you originally alluded to, being rolled off. Two different techniques, and each appropriate for the band that they're in, and that was part of the synergy that made it happen.
Man, that's the
800. Yeah?
Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
The 8100 is essentially a three-band process, so people don't realize it.
I got a question for you. I understand you may know one of our guests from a previous week, a certain person by the name of Skip Peasy.
Oh, and you may, Skip.
And you may have a story.
Well, Skip and I have known each other since, we have more than one, Skip and I have known each other since 1972. I met Skip, he was doing a remote at WGTB, he was in the window record store. WGTB was a Georgetown University station, and I spent 4 years there with Skip, being a non-matriculating Georgetown student playing with the radio station with Skip. And when I saw him, he had two Shure M67s and some Sansui preamps lashed up, and I was studying for my first phone, and I was being the obstinate person I still am. I said, I don't think that will pass FCC proof of performance. And he looks at me and he says, can you fix things? And that was the beginning of my radio career.
Hey, I'm gonna pick up a question from the chat room because I think this is going to add an interesting perspective about Bill. I have a question for Kim. Kim, what do you admire about Bill?
What do I admire about Bill? He's a genius. I mean, he's an analog guru. He's taught me everything I know about audio processing, you know, audio circuit design, how to make things sound natural and clean and how they were meant to sound, I love him, you know? He's taught me everything, and he really...
Kim woke my creativity back.
He wouldn't be back in the radio industry if it.
We've designed seven products together for Henry Engineering as a team, and Kim has been quite a contribution to my life, and like I said, kind of woke up the Rip Van Winkle designer here.
It may have been a bad idea, though. Now that I'm getting deeper into it, I'm learning. No, I'm just kidding. We're actually working on a design right now, which is still secret until probably after the AES convention this November in Las Vegas. It's in San Francisco.
Oh, and speaking, you were talking about processing for streaming. I'm chairing the streaming committee for streaming media for the AES convention. I'm also on the low fatigue listening panel at the AES this fall. And we never discussed my work with the AES and Pin 1.
Or your CD player.
The CD player.
And how that affected straight wire audio. How did that CD player affect straight wire audio, Bill?
It put us out of business.
Why was
what?
That?
Now, you said this earlier in the show, I just got to ask about that. When I became familiar with straight wire audio, I knew about the phono preamp, right? Which was a fantastic phono preamp. I bragged about it early in the show. Hey, in fact, Chris Tobin, come in here a second, Chris. You actually used the CD player. I didn't. I saw them at shows, but this was in kind of the early days of CD players, right?
And yes.
go ahead. Tell what your experience in the NASCAR.
It was a time when, you know, the digital technology and CDs, the magic, if you will, of CDs and what it could do, and audio tape is now something people see. It's like not fading out then, but it was just like, what? This is better. This can recreate what you hear. Bill's box unit, pristine. I mean, everything about it was just like, wow. And I know friends of mine who had them, and they were like, you couldn't describe it. It was a great approach. Everything about it was just spot on. And you know, I'm sorry to hear that it was giving you such grief business wise, but it was a great unit. And for its day, for what was going on, the technologies that were available, the electronics and everything about it, because we had, at one of the stations I worked at, we actually had a couple of Sony players that came from overseas. Yeah. And they were wild. I mean, listening to that audio, listening to straight wire audio, it's hard to... I wish I had recordings and pictures just to show people, wow, check out what was going on back in the early days, which you take for granted now. Or actually, I guess people don't even use CDs anymore. Or do they?
Yeah, CDs. I've got boxes of them. What are those for? So Bill, okay, you've got engineers that love this product. Now, maybe you can give us a lesson in what not to do if your company makes a fabulously popular product.
Well, we had just made funnel preamps and distribution amps and stuff like that. And,
This was the first U.S.-made CB player for professional use.
Right. And we were using a Philips transport. Which is the root of the problem. But and we actually were paying attention to the audio stages, which apparently was not happening in Japan. They were using these filters made out of ceramic capacitors. And, of course, I learned my lesson about that. And so we had a better sounding player. I first oversampled one, I think. To avoid some of the filtering problems. But we had a problem, and when we shipped them, they would not play when they went to the other place. If I took some to WHUR here in D.C. and under my arm, they were still playing like 10 years later. But we discovered after we had gone pretty deep into this and bought an Instapak machine to pack them in foam and everything, that the lasers were getting knocked out of alignment during shipment, and literally about a week before we actually had to close the door at Straight Wire Audio, my assistant Ning, who was a nice young man who was very good, came up with a piece of cardboard and cut and called it laser lock, and he put it into the drawer, and it had a hole to hold the laser, and he's like bashing the player around the office and taking it back out and playing it.
And part of the whole...
I was like saying, oh God, Ning, why didn't you think of this like 6 months ago?
Now, part of the thing, the whole demise of Straight Wire, is the product was so popular.
The
so
orders
people...
for the pop, we had like five times our annual volume in orders for just this one product.
And but you couldn't ship them reliably.
And, you know, we had to go to the bank and get money and everything.
Didn't UPS become your biggest customer for a while?
Yeah, for a while, UPS was our biggest customer because all the claims against it. And then we found out that Philips had been shipping these transports quietly in air shock trucks, but not telling us. So anyway, I went off and did live sound for a couple of years.
Also, Philips was shipping them very gently, but not telling you, hey, you need to ship these gently.
Right. We were getting them from a warehouse in Baltimore and not being told how carefully they were shipping the things. Because they figured that we were buying a consumer player and ripping it apart, stealing a transport, that it had just the right stuff for us. And so that was the problem, that they didn't figure they'd go on a truck after they hit the distribution centers.
Now, it seems like your CD player had a function that was critical to broadcasters that nobody else was producing.
Yeah? That was it could up-cue a record. We up-cue, called it the CD-cue. It had a pot.
Yeah?
Yeah, it had a potentiometer on it that would set a delay, and the potentiometer was a log pot. So the first half of the rotation was up to 1 second, you know, for just stuff that was loose, and then you could turn it up to about 15 seconds, really, on the extreme for something where you just wanted to come up past a point to cue it up. a little pre-cue. So it had a cue button, and it would go back to that same point, and you then have the instant start, which a lot of the early CD players really didn't have an instant start. You push the button and go read a book.
Well, and the other problem was, as I recall, and I was engineering at a rock station in Lexington, Kentucky, 98 Rock Double Q, when CDs came out, and we got a CD player, we got a few CDs, we were playing, you know, Billy Joel or Billy Idol or whoever, and what we noticed was that the mastering of the CDs was quite sloppy compared to what it could have been, and so when you'd cue a track up, you know, track five, yes, for example, and then hit play, well, it might start, or they might have mastered it to start a couple of seconds in, and that exactly was a problem for broadcasters.
And that was our main feature, was the cueing, and a few people discovered, incidentally, it had much better audio than the Japanese player.
We just got a couple minutes left, and I want to let Chris Tobin ask a question about a product that I had no experience with that you made, but I know other people did. Chris, what you got?
I used, back in the day, for matrix processing, the straight wire audio cards. I don't know how popular they were with folks.
Yeah, that's funny. We made those boards for cart machines originally so that you could put L plus R and L minus R on the two tracks of the cart machine. And
right, like the Tomcats,
right? And so I was making those for that, and in a sleazy effort to boost sales, I wrote an article in Radio World. I used to write a column for them, suggested that you put your compressors in L plus R, L minus R, and I started a joke that turned out to be a really bad joke, but in fact, there's one product from a guy who was a customer of mine, I'll just leave unmentioned, that basically was my tutorial to him about this. And it's become pretty popular. So anyway, the matrix processing, the funniest part about that is I got a phone call from a guy named Sid Feldman, late Sid Feldman, who had produced records by the Ronettes and stuff like that for Phil Spector, and told me that I had rediscovered the secret of the wall of sound to compress the L plus R and L minus R separately.
Yeah.
They were great cards. They did well for me. I learned a lot, and there are some pitfalls and some obstacles when you do matrixing, but for me and some of the markets I worked in, it gave us a competitive edge. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. I think the most popular product, actually, that we ever had at Straight Wire Audio was the one of the least glamorous, which was the replacement boards for ITC card machines.
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, yeah, I use those.
Yep.
We sold like a champ. Those things. The guy from Fidelity.
They were good. Those cards were great for the ITC replacement. I use them a lot.
Yeah, well, we made a lot of those boards, and those boards had some unique stuff in them that they did really well competitively. We used to beat Tomcats with them, and that was always fun because the Tomcat was such an excellent machine.
Sure, yeah. Oh, man, we are really talking inside baseball here, and I wish we had more time to do that, but we're about out of time. So I'm going to hit the round robin here. I know Tom said he had something going on the transmitter side he needs to cut out. So, Tom, I want you to say goodbye to us.
Goodbye to us. I mean, see you next time, Kirk. Thanks a lot, and thanks, Bill and Kim. It's been very, very interesting. Very, very interesting chat tonight.
Tom, thanks for being here. Remember, next week it's a free-for-all. It's a, you know, from the trenches war stories episode. So bring your war stories, Tom, okay?
And I'll bring my pick and shovel because it's for the trenches. Anyway.
and Chris Tobin, thank you for being here also from Manhattan, Midtown.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, and Bill and Kim, Bill, Straight Wire Audio Products, I've used a lot of them, made many things, done many things with them, and Competitive Edge along with the Orband products and your stuff. Sweet, right on, spot on.
Thank you so much.
And Bill and Kim, hey, thank you for being with us. Why don't you tell us, we've been having it on the Super, but Bill and Kim, tell us your website and what people will find there when they type it in.
Well, you can go to www.optima.fm, not .com. .com is the mothership. We are .fm and .am. We have an FM site and an AM site.
We are a symbiotic parasite to Orban, so we get the .fm.
And you can view some of our OptiMod videos on there. Most of them are probably going to be 8100s, but we do have some AM units there.
And an 8000 there.
Yeah. And you can also scroll down a bit. There's a link to the Orban Museum run by our friend Exfon over in Greece. It's an excellent site with a lot of information. And you'll also find some of our friends on there, a little bit of a link exchange.
And, not a particularly – we keep wanting to put our endorsement page on, but we're about to do Bob Orban's Reference 8000, and we want him to be the first endorsement on the page, so we're waiting for that.
And if you want to get a hold of Bill and I, you can email us at service@optimod.fm, or you can add either one of us on Facebook. You can find Bill through Bill Sachs. You'll see his picture. It's a little...
My picture on Facebook is a circuit board, so you can always tell it's me.
And then you can look for me as well. I'm listed as Kim Sachs, Kimberly Sachs, or Kim O'Brien, my maiden name.
Kim O'Brien. Sounds like an air name, actually.
Oh, I've met a lot of O'Briens in the industry, and none of them are real O'Briens.
I know. What is up with that? The most popular...
I don't know. They just want to be Irish, I guess. It's a cool thing to do.
Well, I obviously, look, I've just really enjoyed having you guys on the show. You're both a real pleasure to know and a pleasure to meet with at NAB shows. And I know I've had drinks and dinner with you. So it's and besides that, you're good at what you do with analog audio processing, especially in the OptiMod. So we thank you for being our guest. And I want to have you back sometime. And maybe you can take us through, you know, some more of the stories and some more of the specifics of what you can do to resurrect old analog processing. Now, we covered a lot of it, but we just didn't get to everything. So we'd love to have you back sometime.
And I'll give you the tape of the full interview with Bob, and you can post it wherever you want. People can download it and listen at their leisure, or you can make it its own segment.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Bill, and thanks, Kim. And, hey, we want to remind everyone that you can get the This Week in Radio Tech show at the iTunes store. You can subscribe to it, get it automatically downloaded to your PC, your Mac, or your iPod or iPad or iPhone every week. You can also get our RSS feed right from the website at thisweekinradiotech.com. And you can go to the website, thisweekinradiotech.com, listen to it right there, download it right there. You got all these options. Not a problem. And of course, you can watch it live on the Twit Network, as you might be doing right now if you're watching it live on the Twit Network. We do the show every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, and 5 Pacific Time. I don't know when it occurs Mountain Time. Next week, it is a war story show, so that's going to be a lot of fun. We'll bring our war stories with us and talk about our time in the trenches. Take questions from the chat room, too. That's always a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.